Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Talking Simpsons Network interview special. I am one of your hosts, Bob Mackey, who is here with me today.
Henry Gilbert, and right now all my subtitles are in yellow font.
You know, Henry, I was tiptoeing around in the Talking Simpsons Network archive. It's sort of like that end scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, and you'll never guess what happened.
What?
I found a missing interview that we never posted.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, it was recorded in the year of February, the month of February in the year of 2018.
Yes.
God, it was like it was almost yesterday, but it was actually close to 8 months ago, and we interviewed the great Robert Woodhead.
Yes, this really takes me back now. We interviewed him right when we were launching three other podcasts at the same time.
And for months, we forgot that we did this because so much was happening. Live shows, multiple series launching, the Patreon was changing, lots of things were happening all at once.
And so things fall through the cracks sometimes, including this interview with Robert Woodhead. Well, who is Robert Woodhead? What's so important about him? Maybe if you listen to our recent Robotech podcast, you'll understand what a big deal it was to get unedited and subtitled anime in America back then. And that was the case with Animego, Robert Woodhead's company that he co-founded, to release tons of Japanese animation that America wouldn't see, and usually much more obscure than you'd see in from other places. Like, the big name companies would get certain things, but Animego found the quality stuff that other people weren't really hearing about, and I was a big fan of Animego back then.
So it should be noted that we mentioned the Gunsmith Cats Kickstarter in this episode, so that was successful. You don't need to support it, but you can buy the DVD because it's out now, right? Or the Blu-ray
collection of that too. Same. Look up the Blu-rays for Rice Fighting Bean, Otaku no Video, Bubblegum Crisis. There's tons of great Animego things still available, and their Blu-rays they put out, I was just watching the Otaku no Video one the other day. They put so much effort into the extras on that stuff that you would not expect other places to do.
And who knows, maybe they will show up on What a Cartoon someday. It was funny, we recorded this before What a Cartoon had been released in its first episode form.
Yep. This really takes me back. That really does feel like a long time ago now.
80 years ago. So it's funny that my podcasting partner on Retronauts, Jeremy Parrish, talked to Woodhead independently with us not communicating at all.
That's right. You can
hear him on Retronauts episode 162 talking about wizardry, because not only did Robert Woodhead have a great deal of things to do with anime, he also had a lot to do with wizardry, the RPG series that was super influential. So Robert Woodhead, he's just a renaissance man of all these super nerdy things.
Yeah, I think we touch on wizardry just a little bit here, but we wanted to focus more on Animego, the animation they licensed in America, and where they're at right now. Or by right now, I mean in February. But Robert was a great guest. You should follow him on Twitter at Animego. And he was a really cool guy to do this. I'm super sorry this fell through the cracks, Robert, if you're listening to this. Hey, now the whole world can hear this.
Yes, so please enjoy our interview with Robert Woodhead.
Hi, everybody. It's Henry here with Bob.
Hey, how's it going?
And we are here with the co-founder of Animego, Robert J. Woodhead. Hello.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Well, so how's it going, Rob?
Oh, well, we're pretty busy getting ready for another crowdfunding campaign and just dealing with the day-to-day insanity that is our chosen profession, such as it is.
Well, yeah, and I did pronounce that correctly, right? It is Animego, right?
Yeah. We like to say Animego is our philosophy, Animego is our name.
That's good. We had a conversation about that before we started the recording. Like, how do we? I want to make sure I'm saying this right.
It's a good pun. I love that pun.
Yeah.
I've been a fan of that pun for decades now, I would say. Robert, I guess I wanted to start with asking, like, what you at that company was one of the pioneers of the anime movement in America, or the like localizing uncut anime in the U.S. Why'd you get into that?
Basically, the standard story that I tell, which has the benefit of actually being true, is that the company was started as a joke. And it really got started because when the Macintosh 2 came out, I got this interesting digital video board called the ColorSpace 2. And what it allowed us to do was to basically put graphics on top of video. And so I was playing around with this. And one of the people who was working with me on Wizardry 4, because at that time I was writing computer games, Ro Adams, was a big anime fan. And he asked me if this could be used to subtitle anime, because he was a member of the Cornell Japanese Animation Club. And at the time, since they didn't have any subtitled anime, what they would do is they would play the videos in Japanese, and they would have the one guy in the club who actually spoke Japanese translate in real time.
Wow.
So, sort of like, yeah, just sort of like a verbal sign language interpreter, if you will. And so he said, you know, hey, could we subtitle these so we could show them at the club? And I thought about it and I said, well, you know, I'm always going to Japan on business. I could get some licenses and we could actually release these and try to make some money on them. And 5 minutes later, when we had stopped laughing at how dumb this idea was, and I'm kidding you not, this was a falling down, can't breathe, just choking, almost dying, gasping laughter at how incredibly stupid an idea this was. We sort of, you know, at that time we were so exhausted, we said, yeah, sure, why not? I mean, you know, what's the worst that could happen 25 years later?
I mean, that sounds like the Wild West of anime back then. I was a fan in the 90s, and I mean, I guess I did love Japanese animation in the 80s when I just saw, like, say, Voltron or Speed Racer reruns on TV, but to try to get unedited anime in the 80s, like, that must have been very difficult as just a fan back then.
Well, there was actually a pretty vibrant culture of people trading tapes and having connections in Japan that would record things off the air and then send them to the US, and they'd be copied like 37 times. And so people made do. Like any sort of like really tight-knit small fandom, yeah, you had to be pretty serious about it to want to jump through the hoops.
So when you went out to acquire these licenses, what went into the decision-making of getting the certain properties, and what was the reaction of the companies who presumably had not experienced anything like this before?
Our first license came from Fuji Sankei Communications International, which was one of the big Japanese trading companies. It wasn't actually with the sort of Japanese end of the business. It was sort of like the American subsidiary, their American office. They actually, you know, had two titles we had to choose from. One was Madox, which was the one we chose, and the other was Project Aiko. And we chose Madox because we thought it was a little bit more sort of generally approachable. If we had been smart, we'd, of course, should have done both. But as I said, this was company started as a joke. We're doing it on the weekends when in our spare time, you know, just for fun. And so we just were just kind of, you know, noodling around with it. We didn't want to actually spend like significant amounts of money on it. So we, and also I liked Madox because as a computer programmer, I'm a real big fan of like read the fucking manual. And if that's one thing that video teaches you, it's you should really read the manual.
Well, you mentioned manuals. That was something as a fan of Animego as a kid, I loved the liner notes that came with the works, especially the ones for Yurusai Yatsura were invaluable because there were just so many inside jokes that if you weren't in Japan in 1981, I don't think would make any sense. Did you guys take a lot of pride in the liner notes for your works?
The thing to remember about any sort of business like this is you're basically making it up as you're going along. You really have no idea what you're doing. And so you're constantly faced with decisions about, like, how should we do things? And a lot of times it's just sort of like, well, it seemed like a good idea at that time. In the case of the liner notes, the problem was that we were always seeing that there was a lot of background cultural information that, if you understood it, gave another layer of understanding to the particular show. We definitely, our sort of our impossible goal was to try and give the U.S. watcher the same sort of emotional, the same journey as a viewer of the show that a Japanese viewer would have. But the problem was you Americans don't have some of those cultural background things. And so how are we supposed to convey that? And, you know, there's a limited amount of bandwidth in your subtitles to do that. And there are some things that are just like very hard to pithily translate. So doing the liner notes was sort of our compromise to try and address that problem in an era before you could Google for things, before you had Wikipedia, all that sort of stuff. When you look at all the things that people think that we did that were kind of interesting and cool, they were all, almost all of them were just like, oh, we've got this weird problem. You know, what's the simplest solution to the problem that we can think of and do it? And then everyone thinks that's a great idea and kind of copies it and then comes up with their own spin on it. And then the technology changes. And so sometimes things kind of become fossilized, which I find is really kind of interesting. You know, a lot of things that people think, well, that just makes sense and people do it that way and that's the way we do it. They're kind of like these technological fossils of decisions that were made based on the technological limitations of the time, and they made sense at the time. Now maybe they don't make quite so much sense, but everybody's used to them.
I still just love them. I mean, I did also, you guys on the website was a great resource too, because you would just post the liner notes as well, just in case people lost the inserts that came with the VHSs and then DVDs.
Yeah, and eventually it became more expensive to print those damn liner notes than it did to make the DVDs.
Wow.
Because DVDs are made in the zillions.
Yep.
And, you know, liner notes are sort of like customized things. You print a few thousand of them. Mm. And then you have to pay to insert them in the disc, in the package. So that's when we just started saying, screw it, we'll put them all on, we'll actually include them on the disc. It was cheaper to include them on the disc and do the authoring to do that than it was to actually print them and put them in the package. Also, it was then very cheap to put them on the website. So yeah, I mean, you know, we save like 15 cents a package doing it that way now.
If we can jump ahead in time just a bit, I'm thinking of the period maybe 15 years ago when there was just a really huge boom in terms of physical media in regard to anime, like tons of DVDs. It only lasted for about half a decade, but I was sort of surprised that Animego stayed sort of conservative even at that time. What was your experience during that time for anime on DVD?
In terms of our business philosophy, my personal business philosophy, since like I was the guy who put up the original money, and you know, it was when the company needed money, I came out of the bank of Robert and Natsumi. Natsumi, who, let's be honest, is the real business person she's the one who, she and my mom were the ones who really ran the business. I was more of the technical and allegedly creative person. emphasis on the allegedly. We never wanted to be so aggressive as to ever have like a bet your company decision, you know, where the success or failure of a single project or this sort of like a major sea change in the market would kill us. And so that's why we tended to stay with kind of more niche-y projects. When suddenly anime really boomed and the cost of licenses was getting huge, suddenly we sort of took a left turn and started doing the live action films, all the samurai films. When we first started doing that, that happened because the prices were getting insane. And so I asked, when I was at a meeting at Toho, I asked the people there, well, okay, so it doesn't look like we can afford much anime this time. Have you got anything else you think we'd be interested in? And there was a little conversation, and the assistant, who later became like the head of the entire department, but wow. When I first knew him, he was like the new guy, he gets dispatched off and comes back with a stack of old brochures. And I'm kidding you not, I'm not kidding you here, literally brushing the dust off these things. Maybe you would like to look at something like this. So I start looking, and these are all these old samurai films. And like the third or fourth one down is Lone Wolf and Cub.
Wow.
And even I, who, you know, I enjoy Japanese films and I had a basic knowledge of the live action cinema at the time, you know, I was in no way an expert and still would not consider myself to be an expert. Even I knew how important and cool the Loewen for Cub films were. So it's like, I look at that little brochure and I set it aside and says, well, maybe we can do something with this.
That's surprising that Toho just had that at the bottom, like third on a list of things when, I mean, I guess, did they have an understanding how it was known in the US? Or, cause I in the 90s, I was reading the manga, I believe, that Dark Horse was publishing. So I was definitely aware of it as well.
Well, it was very big culturally in Japan. But the movies themselves were not as popular as the TV series that came later. When you ask Japanese people about Lone Wolf and Cub, they all think of the TV series, okay? And yes, it had been, you know, the movies had been sold theatrically and cut together to form the Shogun Assassin films. But, you know, in terms of doing live-action Japanese films at that time, there was basically only one company that was doing them, and that was Criterion. And they were all into the, you know, the Kurosawa films, the really great artsy films. And we came in and said, you know, there's a lot of just really good, fun, very cromulent films, if you know what I mean.
Oh, we do.
Oh, yes. We definitely get to that.
And so, you know, why not? And so we gave that a try, low risk, see what happened, and it worked out well. That's basically always been our philosophy.
How did the licensing situation change as time went on? Like, did the Japanese licensors get a better sense of what American fans were interested in or what the American market was like, or did you kind of have to explain it quite a lot?
At the beginning, the American market really wasn't a big deal. You know, they made things for the Japanese market, and international sales, if they made them, that was nice, but it was never something that they would depend on. As time went on, the international market became more and more important. And in fact, things got funded internationally. And so these days, you know, international sales, you know, companies from outside of Japan actually being part of the production committees is a much, much bigger piece of the business.
I'm curious as to what you think about streaming anime, because when I talk to younger anime fans now, I feel like grandpa telling them about having to walk uphill both ways. I had to buy one tape with three episodes, but now if you pay $5 for a month, you have access to, I don't know, like 200 series, 200 full series. It's crazy to think about just how much more accessible it is. How do you feel about that as someone who is into selling anime as a physical product?
I really don't have much problem with it. You know, for mass market anime, for stuff that's really, really broad, popular. There are enough people who are interested in it that it makes sense as a distribution method. There's a business model there. You know, for the kind of things that we like to do, which are, again, the niche kind of things, that model doesn't make as much sense because, you know, the people who, you know, every so often we'll just run into something that will just blow up, and that's great. But most of the things we do, we tend to like the 80s and 90s and early 2000s stuff, the really classic stuff. There's an aspect, especially for the crowdfunding campaigns we've done, of sort of like the preservation and conservation and making sure there's sort of like a reference edition available. And I think that's something that appeals to me personally. I mean, I try very hard to only work on projects that I personally enjoy working on. Because the few times that I've kind of given in and said, we I don't super like this, but it's going to make so much money, I got to do it. They've all been complete disasters.
Well, you know, you mentioned your crowdfunding, and I believe your first Kickstarter was Bubblegum Crisis, and that was, I had bought into that one myself, because Bubblegum Crisis, I think, was one of the first Japanimation I got from the Japanimation section at Blockbuster, and was such an amazing thing to me. I'd never seen anything like it. And was that one of the company's first big hits? And I got to think it's got to be a special one to you guys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that was a series where, you know, we'd done Maddox, we'd done Riding Bean, and those were sort of our audition tapes. Those were our demo tapes that we take. They were literally tapes that we take around to people and say, you know, this is what we've been able to do. And that allowed us to get Bubblegum Crisis. And that one, after Bubblegum Crisis, then people started taking these crazy gaijin a little bit more serious.
Yeah, speaking from experience, I can say in the early 90s, the two anime everyone had seen were Akira and Bubblegum Crisis. Those were the two that everyone had seen in some way. So you were very successful in that way.
Yeah, and how did you guys get into Blockbuster Video? Because that, I know for a lot of my friends, that was how we first saw a lot of uncut anime.
You know, we had distributors, and the distributors, it was mostly the distributors. Oh, what were their names? I've totally forgotten. We had a distributor, and that distributor sold it into Blockbuster. We didn't actually make that much money selling into Blockbuster because, you know, they demanded a huge discount. But in terms of helping the market awareness, it was really, really worthwhile. So,
you know, also the crowdfunding thing, I remember, I think you guys were kickstarting before Kickstarter with the Kimegure Orange Road collection. And like, you guys even printed what had to be some of the last new laser discs ever. Did that teach you guys a lot about crowdfunding ahead of the curve on that?
Yeah, it taught me that I should have patented it. No, I mean, yeah, I mean, lots of people had done these in different, not necessarily in anime, but in different things, had done these sort of like, you know, subscription project things. So I don't think that was anything particularly innovative. The idea of using the, you know, the internet to kind of scale it and make it easier to do these kind of projects, I think is what the big innovation of Kickstarter was. No, actually, I think the first one we did that way was Macross.
Oh, yeah. Your guys' Macross was pristine. Like, it was the best Macross I ever saw.
That's because we spent way, way too much money digitally restoring it.
It's beautiful.
Well, it was worth it. It's worth it.
So in terms of Kickstarter, does that really give you an idea of how many units or DVDs you'll sell outside of the people who back it?
To a certain extent, we know that after we run the Kickstarter, a certain, you know, another 30% or so will kind of sign up after the fact. And we do make a few extra copies that we sell on our website. But, you know, once they run out, we do not repress them. So all of the Blu-ray editions that we've done via Kickstarter, they're all limited editions. And we don't use Kickstarter to raise the money for the project. We use Kickstarter basically as a marketing tool because we'd much rather go direct to the real fans and make something that's tailored particularly to what they want. So we can go straight to them and say, okay, what do you want? How do you want it? Make that exactly, and not have to pay distribution fees where, you know, 40, 50, 60% of the money goes to the distribution channel. By cutting that out, we can make a much more sort of detailed, and we can indulge in all sorts of crazy stuff that the real core fans really like.
Well, yeah, Otakuno Video was, I think, my favorite of the Kickstarters of yours I've backed so far, especially the new content made for it, including the new comic that came in it by Sonata. That one especially, I was curious, how did you get new stuff made in, like, who did you talk to get permission to tell a new story in that world of Otakuno Video?
Oh, well, it's very simple. We have extremely compromising photos of Sonata, so he'll do anything we want. No, of course, that's a joke. We've known Mr. Sonoda for many, many, many years, and he's just generally a nice guy. And so when we were doing this, we asked people what they would, on the Kickstarter, we asked them, what would you like? And they were saying, well, we'd like Sonoda artwork. So we asked him, and he said, yeah, I can do that. And he said, well, we'd like him to do a comic. And he said, yeah, I can do that. And then it was like, well, it'd be really nice if you could insert some of the fans into the comic. And he said, yeah, I can do that.
Wow.
Yeah, we did the same sort of thing on Writing Bean, which is great because all the fans that we had a special level of the Kickstarter where if you chose that level, You'd be like one of three or four fans who would actually get their faces in the comic. And in the comic, almost all of them get violently murdered.
That's great. Oh,
that's nice.
Now, the new one that you guys are, at the time of this recording, I believe, about to launch, it's in preview, is the Gunsmith Cats Kickstarter. So why that property in particular? I think I have a guess why, but why why that property in particular did you choose as your next project?
Actually, a lot of people are saying, why are you continually doing all this Sonoda stuff? And it's more or less an accident.
Okay.
It's just that, yeah, we have close relationships with Sonoda and Gainax and the various people that are involved in these projects. But it just turns out that this just organically, the sort of connections between the projects make it just more likely that it will involve people that or companies that have worked on previous projects. And then as it has turned out, the common thread has been they've all been Sonoda inspired works. And, you know, we at any point in time, we often have two or three kind of projects that are kind of noodling along. In fact, just before I got on Skype with you, I'm working on a spreadsheet for another project, not Sonoda related.
Okay.
But that has been kind of percolating for a couple of years. And it's just an accident that Gunsmith Cats, all the sort of, you know, dots got crossed and T's got dotted in time for it to be the next project rather than this one.
I think those are great choices, though, because Gunsmith Cats and Riding Bean have a lot of crossover appeal. You could show them to a non-anime fan and they would probably enjoy it because they're just action movies, really, like very well-animated action movies.
Yep.
Something I love about those 80s and 90s anime is just how influenced they are, too, but by films of the 80s, which I also love, like, mostly from America, but then the volume is turned up to, like, 11, especially in, like, in Riding Bean's case, he does stuff that saw Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone do him in the 80s, you'd be like, well, this is crazy.
No stuntman would ever do that.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the freedoms you have in anime that you didn't have back then in live action films.
I also was curious, you know, Bob hosts a retro gaming podcast also as well, Retronauts, but I didn't want to go too much into your gaming background here, but I was curious, you know, you guys worked on Wizardry, which was, I would say, almost pioneered the genre of role-playing games back in the early 80s. I was curious, especially as someone who lived in Japan, what did you think of games like Dragon Quest or Phantasy Star and other early Japanese RPGs that took inspiration from Wizardry?
I think that's perfectly fine. I mean, Wizardry was inspired by other people's prior work. Everybody, you know, takes what has, like, impressed them and tries to apply whatever the current technology or media is in order to try and do something that they think is cool. And then other people take that and sort of take it a step further. I mean, so that, as far as I'm concerned, that is perfectly natural and fine.
Did you expect them to get did you expect the genre to get so big in Japan as well? Like Dragon Quest is still the biggest thing ever there.
It got huge there first.
Yeah.
The flat out answer is no, because when you're sort of living in the day, your idea of like what's going to happen and then what actually happens, if what you think happens actually happens, you're just lucky.
One last question for me. Back in the day, was there one, you know, that you mentioned Project Echo, was there any other like big series you tried to get and missed out on that you'd wish you had?
Let me think. Well, I was actually a little bit pissed at not getting Gunsmith Cats.
Well, now you got it.
Yeah.
Vengeance is mine.
What was it like? You talked about your closeness with Gainax. Like, you guys put out a talking about video in the U.S. I think before Evangelion happened. And what was it like seeing them go from not small, but definitely not as big as they were for Ava when that came out? Like, what was it like seeing that?
Most of the people that I've run into in the anime business have just been like genuinely good people. And, you know, I'm always happy when people I like find success. So that's cool. And, you know, I think it's wonderful, you know, how big Ava became.
Robert, can you plug your latest project again for everybody?
Okay, well, it's what we're currently calling the Gunsmith Cats Explosive Edition. It will probably start the Kickstarter campaign second week in March. We still have to get final approvals and stuff like that, but we're doing a couple of fun things with it that we haven't done before, which also need to get final approvals. One of them that I think is going to be kind of fun, assuming we are allowed to do it, is having a fan art contest, because we're doing an art book, and Mr. Sonoda has agreed to be a capricious and arbitrary judge.
That's great.
Nice.
Fans will get to submit their sort of one-page art, and the best ones will get printed in the art book.
Awesome. And
what an honor.
I'm looking forward to that. Well, thank you very much, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So thanks again to Robert Woodhead for sitting down for an interview with us. And again, we apologize for it being posted so late. Like every few weeks, I would think, didn't we interview somebody else? Nah. And then finally, like, Henry, check your computer. There's an interview we're missing.
But we have it now.
Yeah.
So,
now we've got like 16 interviews on the old network.
Oh,
there.
My goodness. So many. And yeah, I think we're honestly kind of running out of available Simpsons people. So I like too that interviews like this or the one we did with Ian Jones Quarty back in 2017, we can do more just animation interviews thanks to the What a Cartoon brand as well.
What a Cartoon has expanded our scope so greatly, and who knows what our next miniseries will bring in 2019. Even more writers and animators we could talk to.
Yeah, and if you enjoyed this, please let @AnimeGo know on Twitter how much you like this. And again, thank you so much, Robert, for doing this podcast with us. We look forward to tons of other cool interviews in the future.
Yes, thanks so much for listening, folks. We'll see you again on the next interview podcast. Thank you.